so we proceed to make investments. Investments in people, investments in education, and I want to commend this state and this university. Let me just reaffirm what you know. There has never been a state, there has never been a city, a county, or a nation that has become insolvent because of its investments in education. Investments in people. We're making investments in the health of our people, in our cities, in retraining, in a more productive America. Yes, investments in equality at the ballot box and before the law. And these are basic investments that will stand us well for the years to come. Now, if we can build a society that works on all cylinders, to use an old-fashioned phrase, before the jet engine, I think that others in the world may have some hope of doing it. But my fellow Americans, if we can't make freedom work, who can? If we can't overcome the problems of poverty and injustice, who can? If we can't gear up an economy for the long pull, who can? With all that we have, with the tools that are at our command, with the science and technology with which we're blessed, with our unbelievable capacity in industry, in agriculture, if we can't make freedom a reality for everyone, what hope is there in the rest of the world? Now, let me say just a word then as I close about the nature of that responsibility of leadership. Leadership isn't doing it our way, stamped USA. Leadership in today's world requires far more than a large stock of airplanes, gunboats, or a hard fist at the conference table. Leadership requires more than the ability to go it alone. Leadership today requires the understanding of the problems that we face, the understanding of the resources at our command, and above all, the objectives that we seek. And I think that it requires, perhaps even more to lead, the ability to inspire others, to challenge them, to lift them, and to seek their cooperation in a common enterprise. For strong and rich as we may seem, and we are, our goal of a just and a peaceful world will never be reached or achieved by America alone. It's too big for us alone. It will be achieved only when the resources of the strong and the weak, the rich and the poor, are allocated in the most effective manner possible. The challenges that are far too great for any one nation to overcome. Now, I don't think I need to call to your attention the challenge that faces this nation tonight, but maybe for this fleeting moment it would be worthy of your time. We've been trying for a long time to bring a halt to the grim race towards world destruction that is contained in the proliferation, in the expansion, in the dispersion of the nuclear weapons. An increasing number of such weapons and delivery systems in the hands of an increasing number of nations, many of them with irresponsible leadership, could lead inevitably to the ghastly mistake or miscalculation which could bring a nuclear holocaust. I didn't come here to frighten you because I don't believe in the politics of fear. I come here as a member of the National Security Council, as chairman of the Space Council, as one that is privy to the innermost secrets of this land. And I can only tell you this, that the nuclear arsenal of this world today is so big that no living thing can survive if man goes into the madness of nuclear war. Now, we have made it, and we shall continue to make it, our highest national priority that nuclear non-proliferation treaty or agreement be concluded. We would welcome and we work actively, even as this hour, to the adherence of all nations, including Communist China, to such a treaty, knowing full well, may I say, regrettably, that that adherence may be long in coming, if at all. The stakes for mankind are far too high for any other course. This then is the test that we must set for ourselves, not to march alone, but to march in such a way that others will wish to join us, not to speak with just arrogant pride of our America, but to be firm without being belligerent, to be strong without being bellicose, to be compassionate without being weak, and to be just without appeasement. And my fellow Americans, I think that every one of these goals that I've uttered for you tonight are within our reach. I happen to believe that if we have the will, if we muster the resources, if we determine our course, that with others of like ideals and objectives, there is a better day ahead, and there is a world of peace, a peace of progress, a peace that's filled with action, a peace that means growth. And thank goodness that I come to a state tonight, to a society and an honored group that by its very title and by its very personality symbolizes growth, symbolizes enterprise, symbolizes personal achievement, symbolizes intellectual excellence, and symbolizes dedication to the cause that this nation represents, the cause of mankind. Thank you very much.
Just heard an address by the Vice President of the United States.
Who and what are you? I am the ghost of Christmas past. Oh, Christmas past? Long past? No. Your past, Ebenezer Scrooge. What brings you here? Your welfare.
It put out its strong hand as it spoke and clasped him gently by the arm.
Rise and walk with me.
Would have been in vain for Scrooge to plead that the weather and the hour were not adapted to pedestrian purposes. That the bed was warm and the thermometer a long way below freezing, and that he was clad but lightly in his slippers and dressing gown and nightcap, and that he had a cold upon him at the time. The grasp, though gentle as a woman's hand, was not to be resisted. He rose, but finding that the spirit was making towards the window, he clasped its robe in supplication and said,
I am immortal. I am liable to fall. Bear but a touch of my hand there on my heart. You shall be upheld in more than this.
As the words were spoken, they seemed to pass right through the wall and stood upon an open country road with fields on either hand.
Good heaven! Good heaven! I was bred in this place! I was a boy here! Cried Scrooge.
The spirit gazed upon him mildly, while Scrooge was conscious of a thousand odors floating in the air, each one connected with a thousand thoughts and hopes and joys and cares long forgotten. The ghost and Scrooge walked along the road until they came to a schoolhouse, where as they entered, they saw a lonely boy reading near a feeble fire. And Scrooge sat down at a desk and wept to see his poor forgotten self as he had used to be. Not a latent echo in the house. Not a squeak and scuffle from the mice behind the paneling. Not a drip from the half-thawed water spout in the dull yard behind. Not a sigh among the leafless boughs of one despondent poplar. Not the idle swinging of an empty storehouse door. No, not a clicking in the fire, but fell upon the heart of Scrooge with softening influence and gave freer passage to his tears.
It's too late now. What's the matter? Oh, nothing. Nothing.
There was a boy singing a Christmas carol at my door last night. I should just like to have given him something, that's all. The ghost smiled thoughtfully and waved its hand, saying as it did so, "Let us see another Christmas." And although they had but that moment left the school behind them, they were now in the busy thoroughfares of a city. It was made plain enough by the dressing of the shops that here, too, it was Christmas time again. But it was evening, and the streets were lighted up. The ghost stopped at a certain warehouse door and asked Scrooge if he knew it.
"Know it? Wasn't I apprenticed here?"
They went in. At the sight of an old gentleman in a Welsh wig sitting behind such a high desk that if he had been 2 inches taller, he must have knocked his head against the ceiling, Scrooge cried out in great excitement, "Why, it's old Fezziwig! Bless his heart, it's old Fezziwig alive again!" Old Fezziwig laid down his pen and looked up at the clock, which pointed to the hour of 7. He rubbed his hands and adjusted his capacious waistcoat and laughed all over himself from his shoes to his organ of benevolence and called out in a comfortable, oily, rich, fat, jovial voice, "Yo-ho, Ebenezer, Dick!" Scrooge's former self, now grown a young man, came briskly in, accompanied by his fellow apprentice.
"Dick Wilkins, to be sure. Poor Dick," said Scrooge to the ghost.
"Yo-ho, my boys! Yo-ho, no more work tonight! Christmas Eve, Dick! Christmas Eve, Ebenezer! Clear away, my lads, and let's have lots of room here! Hi-lee-o, Dick! Cheer up, Ebenezer!" Clear away? There was nothing they wouldn't have cleared away or couldn't have cleared away with old Fezziwig looking on. It was done in a minute. Every movable was packed off as if it were dismissed from public life forevermore. The floor was swept and watered, the lamps were trimmed, and fuel was heaped upon the fire, and the warehouse was as snug and warm and dry and bright a ballroom as you would desire to see upon a winter's night. In came a fiddler with a music book and began tuning like 50 stomach aches. In came Mrs. Fezziwig with one vast, substantial smile. In came the 3 Miss Fezziwigs, beaming and lovable. In came all the young men and women employed in the business. In they all came, one after another, some shyly, some boldly, some pushing, some pulling. In they all came anyhow and everyhow. And away they all went, 21 couples at once, hands half round and back again, down the middle and up again, round and round, old top couples turning up in the wrong place, new top couples starting when they got there, all top couples at last, and not a bottom one to help them. And when this result was brought about, old Fezziwig clapped his hands to stop the dance and cried out, "Well done!" And the fiddler plunged his hot face into a pot of porter. Well, during this first dance and the scenes that followed, Scrooge had acted like a man out of his wits. His heart and soul were in the scene with his former self. He corroborated everything, remembered everything, enjoyed everything, and underwent the strangest agitation. It was not until now, when the bright faces of his former self and Dick were turned from them, that he remembered the ghost. Became conscious that it was looking full upon him. "A small matter to make these silly folk so full of gratitude."
"Small,"
echoed Scrooge, flinching noticeably.
"What's the matter?"
asked the ghost.
Nothing in particular. Well, something, I think. No, I should just like to be able to say a word or two to my clerk. That's all. My time grows short.
Again, Scrooge saw himself. He was older now. A man in the prime of life. He was not alone, but he sat by the side of a fair young girl in a mourning dress in whose eyes there were tears.
It matters little,
she said softly.
It matters little to you, very little. Another idol has displaced me, and if it can cheer and comfort you in time to come, as I would have tried to do, I guess I have no just cause to grieve.
What idol has displaced you?
A golden one.
Oh, well, what then? Even if I have grown so much wiser, what then? I am not changed towards you.
Oh, yes, Ebenezer, you are. Our contract is an old one. It was made when we were both poor and content to be so, until in good season we could improve our worldly fortune by our patient industry. You are changed. When we were engaged, you were another man.
Oh, I was nothing but a boy.
Your own feeling tells you that you were not what you are now. But I am. That which promised happiness when we were one in heart is fraught with misery now that we are two. How often and how keenly I have thought of this, I will not say. It is enough that I have thought of it and can release you with a full heart for the love of him you once were. I release you.
She left him, and they parted.
Spirit! Spirit, show me no more! Conduct me home! Why do you delight to torture me?
But the ghost was gone, and Scrooge was conscious of being exhausted and overcome by an irresistible drowsiness. And further, of being in his own bedroom. He had barely time to reel to bed before he sank into a heavy sleep.
Night divine. was born.
The ghost of Christmas Present appeared at the appointed time. And after Scrooge awakened and collected himself, he spoke to the ghost of Christmas Present submissively.
Spirit, spirit, conduct me where you will. I went forth last night on compulsion. And I learned a lesson which is working now. Tonight, if you have aught to teach me, let me profit by it.
Touch my robe.
Scrooge did as he was told and held it fast. He led him straight to the home of Bob Cratchit, Scrooge's clerk. Mrs. Cratchit was anxiously asking, "Whatever has happened to your father and to your precious brother, Tiny Tim? And Martha warned us late last Christmas by half an hour." "Here's Martha, mother," said a girl, appearing as she spoke. "Here's Martha, mother," cried the two young Cratchits. "Hurrah, there's such a goose, Martha." "Why, bless your heart alive, my dear, how late you are." "We'd a deal of work to finish up last night," replied the girl. "And I had to clear away this morning, mother. Oh, but I shall lie abed tomorrow morning." "Oh, well, never mind, so long as you are come. Now sit ye down before the fire, my dear, and let's have a warm Lord bless ye." "Oh, no, no, there's your father coming," cried the two young Cratchits, who were everywhere at once. "Hide, Martha, hide." So Martha hid herself, and in came little Bob, the father, with at least 3 feet of comforter, exclusive of the fringe, hanging down before him, and his threadbare clothes darned up and brushed to look seasonable, and Tiny Tim upon his shoulder. Alas for Tiny Tim. He bore a little crutch and had his limbs supported by an iron frame. "Why, where's our Martha?" cried Bob Cratchit, looking around. "Not coming. Not coming. Not coming on Christmas Day?" Martha didn't like to see him disappointed, even if it were only in a joke. So she came out prematurely from behind the closet door and ran into his arms, while the two young Cratchits hustled Tiny Tim and bore him off into the wash house that he might hear the pudding singing in the copper. "And how did little Tim behave?" asked Mrs. Cratchit. "Ah, as good as gold," said Bob. "And better. Somehow, he gets thoughtful sitting by himself so much, and he thinks the strangest things you ever heard. He told me, coming home, that he hoped the people saw him in church because he was a cripple, and it might be pleasant to them to remember upon Christmas Day who made lame beggars walk and blind men to see." Master Peter and the two ubiquitous young Cratchits went to fetch the goose, with which they returned in high procession. Such a bustle ensued that you might have thought the goose the rarest of all birds, a feathered phenomenon, to which a black swan was simply a matter of course. And in truth to tell, it was something very much like that in that house. Mrs. Cratchit made the gravy hissing hot. Master Peter mashed the potatoes with incredible vigor. Miss Belinda sweetened up the applesauce, Martha dusted the hot plates, and Bob took Tiny Tim beside him in a tiny corner at the table
and the two young Cratchits set chairs for everybody, not forgetting themselves, and mounting guard upon their posts, crammed spoons into their mouths lest they should shriek for goose before their time came to be helped. At last the dishes were set on, and grace was said. And it was succeeding by a breathless pause as Mrs. Cratchit, looking slowly all along the carving knife, prepared to plunge it into the breast. But when she did, and when the long-expected gush of stuffing issued forth, one murmur of delight arose all around the board, and even Tiny Tim, excited by the two younger Cratchits, beat on the table with the handle of his knife and feebly cried, "Hurrah!" There never was such a goose. Bob said he didn't believe there ever was such a goose cooked. Its tenderness and flavor and size and cheapness were the themes of universal admiration. But now, the plates being changed by Miss Belinda, Mrs. Cratchit left the room alone, too nervous to bear witness, to take the pudding up and bring it in. Hello! And a great deal of steam. The pudding was out of the copper. A smell like a washing day. That was the cloth. A smell like an eating house and a pastry cook's next door to each other with a laundress's next door to that. That was the pudding. Oh, it was a wonderful pudding. Bob Cratchit said, and calmly too, that he regarded it as the greatest success achieved by Mrs. Cratchit since their marriage. Well, at last the dinner was all done. The cloth was cleared, the hearth swept, and the fire made up. All the Cratchit family drew around the hearth in what Bob Cratchit called a circle, meaning half a one. And at Bob Cratchit's elbow stood the family display of glass, two tumblers and a custard cup without a handle. Then Bob proposed, "A Merry Christmas to us all, my dears. May God bless us." "God bless us, everyone," said Tiny Tim, the last of all. He sat very close to his father's side upon his little stool, and Bob held his withered little hand in his as if he loved the child and wished to keep him by his side always, but dreaded that he might be taken from him. "Spare it," said Scrooge with an interest he had never felt before. "Spirit, tell me if Tiny Tim will live." "I see a vacant seat in the poor chimney corner, and a crutch without an owner, carefully preserved. If these shadows remain unaltered by the future, the child will die." "Oh, no," cried Scrooge. "No, kind spirit, say we'll be spared." Scrooge bent before the ghost's rebuke and trembling cast his eyes upon the ground. But Scrooge stopped short upon hearing his own name. "Mr. Scrooge," said Bob, "I'll give you Mr. Scrooge, the founder of the feast." "The founder of the feast, indeed," said Mrs. Cratchit, reddening. "I wish I had him here. I'd give him a piece of my mind to feast upon, and I'd hope he'd have good appetite for it." "Oh, my dear, the children, Christmas Day. Well, it should be Christmas Day, I am sure, on which one drinks the health of such an odious, stingy, hard, unfeeling man as Mr. Scrooge. Now, you know he is, Robert. Nobody knows it any better than you do, poor fellow." "My dear, Christmas Day. Well, I'll drink his health for the sake of the days, but not for his. A long life to him, a Merry Christmas, and a Happy New Year. He'll be very merry and very happy, I have no doubt." The children drank the toast after her, but it was the first of their proceedings which had no heartiness in it. Tiny Tim drank it last of all, but he didn't care a tuppence for it. Scrooge was the ogre of the family. The mention of his name cast a dark shadow on the party, which was not dispelled for full 5 minutes. But then the scene changed, and out of a moment's indecision,
Scrooge was surprised to hear a hearty laugh. But it was a much greater surprise to Scrooge to recognize it as his own nephew's, and to find himself in a bright, gleaming room with a spirit by his side. If you should happen to know a man more blessed in a laugh than Scrooge's nephew, I'd like to know who he is. Oh, you know what he said? He said Christmas was a humbug. Oh, he's a comical old fellow, that's the truth, and he's not so pleasant as he might be. However, his offenses carry their own punishment, and I have nothing to say against him. I'm sure he must be very rich, Fred. At least you've always told me so, said Scrooge's niece. Well, what of that, my dear? His wealth is of no use to him. He don't do any good with it. He don't make himself comfortable with it. He hasn't the satisfaction of thinking he's ever going to benefit us with it, that's for sure. Oh, they were devoting the evening to games and to music. Scrooge's niece played well upon the harp and played, among other tunes, a simple little air, which had been familiar to Scrooge when he was a child.